The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Sarah Crown.
Why did you write your first book?
I think because I needed somewhere to put this extraordinary experience I'd had. As a little boy, I wanted to become an explorer.
Welcome to the Guardian First Book Awards 2009. Publishers, authors and readers from Waterstones reading groups all over the country...
Tebu, founding member of the four-time Grammy Award-winning group The Black Eyed Peas, releases his first book, Falling Up, a memoir of his life from the streets...
I've never written a book before. What are the major challenges that I will face?
Having the personal dedication and commitment to seeing your project through from beginning to end.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian First Book Prize 2010. Behind me you can hear the noise of the crowds.
Veteran actor Anupam Kher released his book, The Best Thing About You Is You.
And the winner is Alexandra Harris. Romantic
models. I didn't think this speech would make it out of my handbag, but I'm completely amazed and delighted.
Yeah, I finished. Can I tell you something, man? It's the first book I ever read.
Spring is finally here. The sun is shining, the air is softening, blossom is frothing on the branches, and the green shoots of literature are sprouting too. Everywhere we look at the minute, there are debut novels bursting forth, so many that it can be difficult to know which to pick up, which is where we come in, of course. Our first debut novelist, however, didn't need any help from us. Justin Torres has taken his native US by storm with We the Animals, an intimate account of growing up in a mixed-race family a bit like his own. Three brothers make mayhem together while Ma and Paps battle with the stresses and strains of living on the breadline and each other. But as Joel and Manny start flunking out of school, it becomes clear that the Trinity cannot hold, and the discovery of a journal throws the bonds between them into question. Richard Lee woke Justin up at home to ask about his experience as a first-time writer.
What's it like being a hot young debut author? Are you having fun?
You know, I am having fun, and it's weird to... have that label put on me at times.
I don't know, enjoy it. Go for it.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. I think that it's nerve-wracking sometimes to think about expectations for the next book.
Sure.
But other than that, I'm enjoying it, yeah.
Fantastic. I mean, you know, 4 weeks on the NPR hardcover fiction bestseller lists. You're 26 on the New York Times hardcover fiction list. I mean, this is something else.
I mean, yeah, and it was such a small little book that was, you know, it wasn't a conventional novel, and, you know, it's kind of fragmented, and I wasn't expecting, you know, I wasn't expecting any of it. I don't think my publisher was expecting any of it, so it's been something.
Where did We the Animals come from?
I mean, it's closely related to my own personal experience. So I have two brothers. My parents were, you know, teenagers when they started having kids. So I started writing, not with any idea that I was going to write this novel. It was more like I was just, you know, experimenting with writing. And I took a lot from my personal experience. I made a lot of things up. I always wrote fiction. Yeah, that was kind of the kernel. And then I kind of obsessively wrote about this family that was similar to my own family. And eventually it kind of cobbled together into a lot of pages. And then I had to, like, think about, like, oh, what do I have here? What am I doing? And, you know, I decided to go for it.
Yeah, because you've been writing mostly short fiction before.
Yeah, and this is, you know, it turned into a novel as I was writing. And when I started, it was kind of short fiction pieces. And then they were, like, always about the same family. So it made sense to kind of see if I could structure it in such a way that it would have a narrative arc, not a traditional narrative arc. It's not really like, you know, what you find in most novels. It's more about this movement from collective we, you know, inclusion in the family to an individual identity and this I that emerges at the end.
You say that the material is, to a certain extent, based on your own life and then the stuff that's been transformed. What do your family make of the transformations?
Yeah, I mean, it was a difficult conversation at first, for sure. When my mother first read things that I was writing in literary magazines or whatever, you know, she would kind of recognize our family and not necessarily see beyond that, you know. And, you know, I've definitely had moments with my brothers or my father that they've treated it as if, like, you know, this moment happened. And I'm like, it didn't happen. I made this up. Like, this is from my head. And so there's that weirdness. But there, overall, we had a lot of conversations about what literature is, what fiction is, that I didn't write a memoir, that I was making myths out of family, that I've kind of, like, used the bones of our family to, you know, to write fictional stories, to, like, write poetry, to make art. And so I think that they get it. I think that they get it, you know, and it's actually been pretty wonderful. They're much more kind of involved and excited about the book than I ever hoped for.
I've read a couple of interviews that you've given, and you sounded surprised that people should focus on the kind of autobiographical nature of it.
Yeah, I think I was a little bit naive. I'd never written a book before. And so, I mean, I was surprised in the first place that the Wall Street Journal wanted to interview me. And then the next surprise was that kind of interviews were consistently about this autobiographical element. I don't know. I think that there's a kind of cultural focus on that right now. I don't think I'm doing anything new. I think that this is something that writers have done since writing began. They borrow from the personal experience. That, you know, there are some books that are very autobiographical. There's some that just, you don't know what's in their autobiography, but it always makes it into any book, I think. And so I was just kind of naively like, yeah, this is what writers do. But I think because there's such a memoir craze right now, people really want to know what happened. Nothing happened. It's essentially made up. I would think about what could they do that would kind of convey an emotional truth that I'm trying to get at.
I want to ask a little bit about where that voice came from, the voice at the beginning, that multi-headed kind of elemental we-ness, that beautifully poised voice that's yet still so firmly in the mind of a kind of 6, 7, 8-year-old boy. Where did that come from?
I think that I put a limitation on myself to try and stay in the moment. There is a kind of retrospective element, but because the kind of remembrances are always firmly in the moment and limited to the moment, it kind of captures what children see. So we, the collective we, I think, were kind of a happy accident. You know, I was waiting for the subway in New York, and it was really late, and I didn't have a pen and paper because I'm a terrible author that way. And I kind of just was thinking about this, you know, this, like, we wanted more. And it was kind of this chant in my head. And I was like, oh, that's good, you know. And so I was forcing myself to memorize, like, the kind of that whole opening passage. And so it's very repetitive and chanty in that way. And then I liked it so much that when I was putting the book together, the collective voice wasn't necessarily something that I was, like, always knew that I wanted. And then once I had this kind of golden nugget, the book transformed around that. Then I kind of ran with that collective voice, and I kind of made the plot of the book the movement from that collective we to the I voice.
The eloquence of that voice, even right at the beginning, the way it's so beautifully done, is that a kind of clue right from the start that this three-headed thing is going to split apart?
Yeah, I hope that the we seems kind of untenable. I hope that that's a signal that, like, you know, no we can last that long.
There's disorder and desperate hunger, all kinds of trouble and so on. But there's also excitement and adventure too. Did you consciously try and find good times among the bad times?
Yeah, I did. When I started writing, I had a really, really great mentor along the way. I took this kind of week-long workshop thing with Dorothy Allison, who's an American writer who's amazing. And she's somebody that I read as an adolescent and always looked up to it, and to get to work with her was like this great opportunity. And one of the things that she said, she was just like, you know, kind of anger at your situation, at whatever, at the situation that your family is in, whatever your anger is, like, it's a fine place to start. It's a great reason to kind of get your butt in the chair, but you can't stay there, and you have to get the grace and the beauty. And that reminder to always get the grace and the beauty in there was something that I have, you know, pin up above my desk, and I consciously, every time I sit down, I make sure that I'm kind of being as compassionate to my character as I possibly can.
Did you worry, I mean, as you were finding these beautiful moments, that you might risk over-romanticizing the poverty you were describing?
If anything, my worries were the opposite. You know, I think that there's a lot of kind of stereotypical, easy representations out there about families like the family I describe in this book. I never thought that I was romanticizing anything. I still don't think I romanticized anything. I think that's a kind of bogus critique, you know, as if people from families in stress, like, never loved each other. You know, that as if, like, poverty means that you like, are constantly, never laugh. Like, no, that's ridiculous. So, no, I never worry about that.
Does it feel different writing now you've published a bestseller?
It does. There's a lot of voices in my head, and it's not just the kind of critics and the, you know, the reviews. You know, it's people that have come up to me and been like, "This, your book meant a lot to me for these reasons. I really like when you write about this," you know, and I like when you do this, and there's just a lot of voices now that I didn't have before. You know, I really nobody's ever heard of me, and I was writing my little book, and I felt absolute freedom. And now it's there's a little bit more responsibility. So yeah, it's different.
Justin Torres embarking on his second novel there, but back here we're still concentrating on debuts. And of course, success like Justin's doesn't actually happen easily, even with authors able to leap into prominence by self-publication on the internet. To demystify the process, I've called in two professionals to talk to me about the business of publishing debut fiction. Selena Walker is a publisher at Random House imprint Century and Arrow, and Leah Woodburn, an associate publisher at Headline, and both have a proven track record in the field. Selena was responsible for S.J. Watson's critically acclaimed best-selling debut, Before I Go to Sleep, and Leah edited Sarah Winman's Richard and Judy Book Club Choice, When God Was a Rabbit. I began by asking Selena, with so many new books coming across your desk, how do you spot the great one?
It's such an imprecise science. I think that what earmarked, certainly Before I Go to Sleep, was the fact that it pulled you in right from the start. I remember how almost the walls of the room sort of rolled back for me as I was pulled into the story. And that doesn't happen very often, particularly not at work. But there I was, totally in Christine's world and wondering what it would be like to lose my memory. Mm. And what I remember particularly about those early pages was I was actually supposed to be having lunch with someone, but I, for an awful, split, agonising second, forgot her name. And I thought, it's beginning. I'm like Christine, I've lost my memory.
And Leah, did you have a similar experience with When God Was a Rabbit? It's a similarly gripping subject matter, isn't it?
It is. It's a different thing, I think, to Before I Go to Sleep, because what Before I Go to Sleep has is a very strong hook. It has that kind of elevator pitch element. Mm. Whereas When God Was a Rabbit was always a really difficult book to pitch, because actually it didn't really have that hook. It was just, there was something special about it, and it's quite hard to define. That came down to the voice. It felt very special and different and kind of new. And so it can kind of come in different forms, I suppose, is the point. It's that special something that's hard to put your finger on, but you know it when you see it. So it's kind of a gut thing, really. And you can sense it because you get this kind of kernel of excitement that grows in your stomach. And if it's still there by the time you finish the book and you've already imagined kind of publishing it and who's going to read it, then it's probably going to be something that you're going to pursue.
Is that an instinct that you learn to trust more the more that you use it, as you sort of continue along your path as an editor? Does it become easier?
I think it probably is an instinct that you do learn to trust the further you go on. It's good to remember that you're not alone as well. So it comes down to the editor to spot these books in the first place. But, you know, it's a very collaborative thing. The next thing that you probably do is share it with a lot of your colleagues. And if they feel the same, then you probably know you're onto something good.
I think it does develop, but I also think that what happens is they start to trust you, your colleagues start to trust you, and that makes a big difference. So when you say, I think I found something, or I think I found something special, if you've had success in the past, then they're more likely to trust you. But of course, that also brings with it a certain level of responsibility, because you can't do it too much.
Yeah.
You know, you have to really pick your shots.
And it's interesting you talking about responsibility, because I wondered whether with a debut novel, the stakes are actually a bit lower. So you can take risks that, you know, with an established author, you might not be able to, or perhaps it's the other way around. I'm not sure. What do you think?
I think that's so. But on the other hand, we do publish quite a lot of debut novels. So we have to, again, be very careful how we pitch them, how we publish them, I think.
Which then actually leads me on to my next question, which is the amount of work that you do as an editor with a first-time novelist. Again, is this something, is it a situation in which you feel you are more essential, you are more involved because the first-time novelist, you know, is just by the nature of the fact that it's his or her first time, is less experienced and needs more support and work from an editor?
I think it completely depends. Editorially speaking, novels come to you in all sorts of shapes and forms, and sometimes they'll come really polished and actually they need very little editorial work, and then other times perhaps they need a much more of a sort of structural, deeper edit. It really does depend. You have to remember that for those authors, it's the first time that they're being published, so the process is completely new to them, and actually it can probably seem quite baffling and mysterious at times.
And I also think it's about trust, because when you've worked over several books with an author, you've probably got a very, you know, you should have a good rapport with them. And you trust them to do what's right for the book and to write the best book they can. And they trust you to help you do that, to help them do that. Whereas for the first time author, it's almost like going on a first date. You know, you really just don't know each other.
What about the charge that's always laid at publishers' doors, that publishing is a bit of a closed circle? It's very difficult to get a publisher to notice your first-time novel if you don't have connections in the industry, if you don't know people, all of that kind of thing. But the internet certainly facilitates these conversations between people who have struggled to get published and feel disgruntled, and that they're sort of being kind of fenced out.
Well, I mean, I think that it is entirely reasonable for people to think, because we, Leah and I, will have done lots of talks to people about first novels, and always there's loads and loads of people who are writing loads and loads of first novels out there, and their big problem is how do they get them published. So I think it's entirely reasonable to see publishing as a bit of a closed shop, because indeed it sort of is, and the first thing they have to do is get an agent, and that was the very, really quite an old-fashioned way of doing it. Now with the internet, that has actually really blown that apart. And we're now having to look much more closely about what's happening on Amazon, and that books do come out of places that you're not expecting them to. And indeed, I ask my colleagues to really, especially the younger ones, to really keep an eye, monitor Amazon, look online. Yeah. You know, that's where the books are going to come from. The big ones will probably still come from the agents, but there's an awful lot of other books out there too.
I was just going to say, I think it's a really interesting time, because for new authors, there is actually a route to market that is an alternative to the publisher route. And that's something we have to be really aware of and not take for granted. So I think that kind of makes our job even more crucial in a way, because as the sort of quality control, I kind of think we're performing a service for readers. We still have great relationships with all the retailers. We have clout because we're so big and established. We can put marketing behind books that you couldn't do if you were doing it yourself.
How do you get your vision over to the reading public? Because actually that presumably is the most important and difficult part in some ways, to say, okay, I think this book is brilliant, but now you all have to read it.
I absolutely think you're right. And it's, again, another very imprecise science. There is, if there was a tried and tested route, we'd all be doing it. I think that what happens is, first of all, the books themselves have to be at a level that they really engage the reader and then deliver. So they will want to make people talk about what's going on. Then I think the internet definitely comes in, because what When God Was a Rabbit was, and also Before I Go to Sleep, they were word of mouth books first. So it's really how you encourage that, and a lot of that was done through the internet and through things like the Amazon buying program, and people writing in saying this was the best book I've ever read. So that is really the way to encourage it, first of all. Their books have to be quite special to do that, but some of them do.
And what Celine is talking about is that word of mouth, really, which I think is the most important thing when it comes to debut novels. I think one of the things that puzzles people kind of when they look at publishing from the outside is the fact that actually it can take such a long time. There can be such a long time between acquiring a book and actually publishing it. It can be a year or more or whatever. But actually, it takes that much time to start generating that word of mouth, and that begins sort of at the moment of acquisition. The editor will start talking about the book in-house, really G-ing up their colleagues about it. And then, in turn, their colleagues have to go out there and pass that enthusiasm on to others. So you'll have your publicity people talking to literary editors and bloggers, and your salespeople would be going out there and talking to retailers and booksellers. And so by the time the book actually comes out, hopefully there's already a conversation about it. Mm. And you combine that with a great cover, some enticing blurb, and the visibility in the store or, you know, on the ebook store or whatever. And hopefully, you know, all those things will combine to make sure that it captures the reader's attention.
None of that costs money. And I think what part of your question is, do you need to have a big marketing spend? Yeah. That's often what people will ask. And actually for both books, or certainly for Before I Go to Sleep, we didn't have a big marketing spend. A lot of it, most of the focus was on getting people to interact with the book. Mm. So, and very often those first novels will not have big marketing spend. You'll want to find out what comes back from the public first before you do that.
It's right. It's much more about kind of passion and enthusiasm and kind of sheer bloody-mindedness. That was definitely the case in them.
But presumably it's not an infallible system. And there must have been books that both of you have published that you've thought were absolutely brilliant and they just haven't caught fire for whatever reason.
Yes, and I think that is more like some books just, in my experience, have sort of fairy dust on the covers and people will pick them up and you sort of get lucky. I think that both When God Was a Rabbit and Before I Go to Sleep, they both had unmissable iconic covers. We're talking about that actually. And they also had very strong pre-publication endorsements from other readers, and some books which are equally good just don't get those three things, in my opinion.
Go on, tell me about the endorsements then, because I always wonder about this. I think, you know, is it just that you're within your publishing firm, you're telling your other authors, you've got to talk about this book? Is that how it works?
Yeah, the elusive blurb. I don't know. It's a funny one. We didn't get any for When God Was a Rabbit, which was really frustrating, actually, because we tried really hard. I think it's getting harder. I don't know if you agree, Selina, but it seems to happen much more easily in the States for some reason. I don't know. But anyway, so we didn't have any for When God Was a Rabbit. What we did do, though, was when we made thousands of proof copies, sort of early reading copies that we were sending out to people, and we covered those with endorsements from people within the company, which may sound a little bit, I don't know, might sound a bit odd, but actually it made a big difference. And because it's such a small industry and people, you know each other, so the people we were trying to talk it up to were agents and booksellers. They kind of knew the people who were stating, you know, their love for this book. So it kind of did make a big difference. And it showed that actually the entire company believed in this book and that, you know, we were putting a lot behind it. So we were quite creative.
Which are the great debuts that you yourselves are publishing and also that you've seen around the industry that you're really looking forward to this year?
Well, the wonderful thing about this year and toward the end of last year is that there is so much riches coming through, and there's some amazing first novels around, novels that I personally am not publishing, which is really sad. But people from the company at the group that I work for are. There's a wonderful book out. I think it's just about to come out, called The Land of Decoration, by Grace McLean. And that's almost like an early Jeanette Winterson, a girl who is young and living in the north of England and being brought up by a very religious father, and she's being bullied at school, and she makes this land, this world, from paper, and she discovers that if she makes it, for example, snow in her own little land of decoration, amazingly, it'll snow outside too. And then I don't know, Leah, whether you read *Up the Age of Miracles*.
I have, which is another. Yes, I tried to buy it.
Yes. And that's wonderful. Seems to be a standout book too.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Who's that by?
That's by Karen Thompson Walker, and Simon & Schuster are publishing that one.
Yes,
lucky them. but no, it's a great sort of dystopian novel. I have two debuts this year that I'm really excited about. One of them is called The Book of Summers by Amelia Hall, and that's kind of a big, beautiful, big-hearted coming-of-age story, really, sort of set in rural Hungary, about endless childhood summers that come to a sudden end for this slightly tragic reason, and you kind of find out at the end of the book, and that's really fantastic. And then I have a book called The Other Half of Me by Morgan McCarthy, and that's kind of a very sophisticated, dark, sparsely written Gatsby-esque novel, which is a big claim. I saw your face then. It's a big claim, but I kind of stand by it. And it's about sort of bright young things dark, murky family secrets, and that's really fantastic too. So those are my two biggies.
Yeah. They sound great. I'm just mainly sitting here now wishing I had your job. It's like so much fun.
It continues to be a bit of a gamble then, bringing out a first novel. And our final debutant, Patrick Flannery, upped the stakes by choosing a fraught and complex subject for his first book, Absolution, which is set in apartheid and post-apartheid South Africa. But Patrick himself is American and grew up in Nebraska, so clearly wasn't following the creative writing school advice of write what you know. I began by asking him where the inspiration for his novel came from.
I don't come to the subject of South Africa as a total outsider. My partner is South African, and I've spent quite a bit of time in the country over the last 10 years, off and on. But the story really emerged out of doctoral research that I was doing in 2005 on the subject of censorship, particularly how it affected Evelyn Waugh's publishing career, and in reading some of J.M. Coetzee's essays on the writer's relationship with the censor in his book Giving Offense, I began to think, I guess in more abstract and narrative terms, about how that might be dramatized. So I began writing a series of dialogues, really for myself, with no intention that it was going to become anything other than a kind of outlet, a creative outlet for myself as I was trying to finish my doctorate.
Technically, this is a very, very complicated novel, again, which is something that one wouldn't normally associate with a first-time novel, which would tend to be a sort of fairly straightforward narrative. Yes. But you have four narrative strands that all appear at the beginning to be telling the same story, but then in fact are telling partial, often contradictory versions of it.
I think in part it came from the way the text began, and it began actually as three very discrete stories, which were in effect almost novellas. Yeah. So there was the story that was the dialogue between the biographer and the writer. And there was a separate story that I was writing about a woman looking after a young boy, and it was a kind of post-apocalyptic dystopia. And then there was a third one, which was very consciously speaking to the same character in the dialogues between the writer and the biographer, and that was about the house invasion that Claire Wald suffers. So they started as these holes, these blocks of narrative, and I didn't entirely know how they were speaking to each other, and it took some years, actually, for me to sort of have enough distance to see the way they could be made to speak to each other and how to begin to braid them together and to add a fourth voice, which is, in a sense, the most historically objective voice. It's sections that have a date and so aspire to some kind of perhaps more objective truth than the other ones. At the end of our interview yesterday, I asked Claire what my purpose was, why she herself didn't write about her past. "You mean why I didn't choose to write a memoir?" she asked. "Yes, or autobiography." She had me at the door and was trying to transfer me over to Mari so that I could be ushered out of the house. "I can't see my life as a totality or as a continuous narrative. I wouldn't know how to write my own life in that way," she said. "But what about fragments?" "Yes, fragments. I suppose I could write fragments. I have written about moments, transitional periods, narratives of personal trauma, specific traumas. I can write about periods of my life, but not my whole life. I wouldn't know what to put in and what to leave out. Or, I guess what I mean is, I would want to leave out so much there would be very little left. That's why I need you."
Move to Mangema,
But of course, truth, I mean, truth is really, it seems to me, what this book is about. And as you say, you have what appears to be an objective narrative in the dated sections.
Yes.
But towards the end of that, we're even shown that, I mean, yes, that's questionable, because as soon as you get into the notion of memory, then you realise that it's all incredibly subjective anyway. and then you also have the sort of the twin shadows of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and obviously apartheid censorship, which we've touched on.
I think with the TRC and the problem of apartheid censorship, I mean, those are very interesting poles between which the story can sort of move. And I wrote these two imagined, fictitious pieces of TRC testimony as a way of speaking directly to that event, that real historical event, but also to speak indirectly to the kinds of activities that one of the characters may have participated in.
But I think that we're sort of slightly in danger of making this sound very technical and dry, which it isn't at all. It's a thriller of sorts. I mean, it's probably about two thrillers, actually.
Yeah.
You paint a picture of post-apartheid society, which is profoundly dysfunctional, where the white middle classes have kind of retreated behind these very high walls and barbed wire.
Right.
Is it an accurate portrait?
Well, it's a portrait of the white middle class South Africa that I know, and it's one way of being in the country, and it's a way that many people choose. There are certainly other ways to be in the country. It's something that my character Sam suggests he understands, and he chooses himself to live in that way, but knows that some of his colleagues and friends would suggest that that was perhaps not the right way to live. And I certainly know people in South Africa who choose to live in a way which is much more open. But it has to be a very subjective choice. I suppose what the book is trying to do is to demonstrate perhaps the kind of terror that people live with as opposed to a terrifying setting, if that makes sense, if that distinction makes sense. So it is possible to be terrified, but I don't think of it as a terrifying place, if that makes sense.
In one of the story strands, again, you allow your author, Claire, to imagine what might have happened to her daughter.
Yes.
She was involved in, we think, anti-apartheid activities. Mm. That, again, that's a deeply shocking section of the book. Mm. And it's difficult, of course, to know as you're reading it how much this is the fabrication of a mother's kind of grief and anguish and regret,
yes,
and how much it's something that really could plausibly have happened. I mean, is it?
No. I think you're referring to Claire's nightmare vision of Laura caged on a beach. But there were certainly covert facilities and there was certainly torture under apartheid. It's just that this is a particularly kind of almost grotesquely aestheticized vision of what torture might be.
And Claire, let's talk about her for a bit. I mean, she's a very formidable and very memorable character. Mm. Did you have any models in mind? You know, she's a great South African novelist. Anyone you were referencing?
No, honestly not. She was always for me about voice, first and foremost. And because she emerged first in this series of dialogues that I was writing, I heard her before actually thinking about who she was in physical terms, even before I thought about gender and age.
And then you also voice Sam as a young boy. That's a yes, pretty big range. Was it difficult to kind of switch between them? Was it difficult to project yourself in either direction?
Yes, it was, actually. Claire was actually the easiest to write, though. I could have written endlessly in Claire's voice, which it just seemed to come from a place within me that I couldn't entirely explain or rationalize. Sam was actually a much harder work, and I'm not entirely sure why that is either, but I think it has something to do with trying to create a voice which is believably both of South Africa but also of America, because he's been in exile in the United States, voluntary exile, not political or forced exile, for many years before coming back to South Africa. So I think I was always slightly uncertain about whether he should sound more American or more South African, and eventually I found a balance, I think.
Mm. And just to return finally to the question of censorship again, which runs through the book, I was really interested in Claire's descriptions of what it's like to write under the eye of censors and how you have to manipulate your own mind in order to become comfortable with it.
It was both Coetzee's essays in Giving Offence, as well as work that the Oxford scholar Peter MacDonald has done in his great book about the institutions of censorship under apartheid, as well as trying to imagine, I think, particularly in 2005, at the kind of at one of the darkest moments of the Iraq War, as an American living abroad, in a moment that felt often very dystopian, what it might be like to live in a regime of total oppression, in which every word posed some kind of risk or danger.
So are you inspired to write your own debut? Let us know on the podcast page at guardian.co.uk/books. If you found us through iTunes, don't worry, the page is easy to find on the Guardian's book site. Just click on the word podcast on the nav bar on the front page. And if you haven't already, why not subscribe and become a regular listener? Here's Richard Lee back in the studio to tell us what we have to look forward to this week. Richard.
In the Guardian Review tomorrow, we have a newly discovered short story by the remarkable Sylvia Townsend Warner, with a commentary by her fan, Sarah Waters. Francis Stoner Saunders reviews Rachel Cusk's controversial anatomisation of a separation, Aftermath. And Nicholas Rowe profiles artistic duo Gilbert and George. In the Observer new review on Sunday, Will Skidelsky interviews the Israeli author Etka Keret. Claire Tomalin reviews the big novel of the spring, John Lanchester's Capital. And Catherine Hakim reviews The Monogamy Gap by Eric Anderson.
And also on the site next week, we'll have the cartoonist Martin Rosen telling us about his updated version of Gulliver's Travels.
Yes,
right?
He's put together an audio slideshow, which will appear on the book site next week, complete with some fascinating sketches, which show how he put the book together. Rosen says he feels a strong sense of connection to the great satirists of the past. But as he was singing the praises of Swift, Hogarth and Cruikshank, I couldn't resist asking him why the body politic is still in such a dire state almost 300 years since Gulliver's Travels was first published.
Well, somebody wants to define satire as corrective surgery with a cudgel. I think it may have been me, actually. But it's not meant to make people behave better. It's meant to make us feel better. So we can laugh at it. We can release all those wonderful endorphins which you release when you laugh. That everything's shit, but actually shit's pretty funny as well. Which is what Swift knew. I hope I was channeling his scatological imperative whilst doing this book. Shit is just funny. And as Orwell said, every joke is a small revolution. And it does redeem you to laugh at things. That it doesn't stop things being terrible. We're all going to die, which is the most terrible thing imaginable. But if we can carry on laughing at it, there's a small bit of hope before we do.
And so with that merry thought ringing in our ears, it's time to say goodbye for this week. Thanks then to Richard, to Justin Torres, Patrick Flannery, Selena Walker and Leah Woodburn. I'm Sarah Crown. From me and producer Tim Maybe, goodbye.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.